The next case is 93-2592, State of Ohio versus Wilford Berry.
Let's accept your proposition for exactly what you said. What standing is there for you to come here to argue?
Your Honor, standing exists in three ways before this. In first instance, I draw the distinction between federal habeas corpus proceedings, where we would be asserting perhaps another person's standing as an ex-friend. We are not an ex-friend at this point. We are appointed by the Court of Appeals during the pendency of the direct appeal litigation. We have never been properly removed from the case. Certainly the trial court attempted to remove us from the proceedings after she determined, or after it determined, that Mr. Berry could properly withdraw his post-conviction petition. I think the most important reason, though, is that under our enabling statute, the Ohio Public Defender seeks to find those cases that are off merit, off indigent individuals. And if nobody is going to be in a position to be permitted to assert those interests and those constitutional rights, then we face a serious danger that capital defendants may fall through the cracks of the system without adequate
remedies. Mr. Bodine, I should premise my question. Is there any situation that you can think of where a defendant a person who's been given the death penalty can choose to forego all appeals and be executed? What situation in your mind would that be?
There certainly is, Your Honor. Certainly there has been. We assert that the state of Ohio shouldn't allow a person to forego state collateral review. But there are a few instances, and I'll use Gilmore, for example, because it has arisen in these proceedings a number of times. In Gary Gilmore's case, there was never any evidence that he was incompetent asserted during those proceedings. He was represented by attorneys. His attorneys, his own retained attorneys, had him evaluated. They determined along with him that he was indeed competent to withdraw his appeals. The basis of the Gilmore decision supports that. Mr. Gilmore's mother winning on the next friend, and it was ultimately dismissed because of an Article III standing issue, not because of a competence.
So there, his attorneys followed his wishes after determining that they were covered by getting a competency.
Yes, Your Honor.
They protected themselves from any sort of suit by determining that he was competent, and then they followed his instructions.
I believe so, Your Honor, and I certainly don't think Mr. Gilmore's attorneys were trying to protect themselves, but I think it was their obligation.
But here Mr. Berry has a problem because he can't find anybody to follow his wishes in terms of legal representation.
In terms of withdrawing completely from review, as a representative of the individual, and certainly fulfilling our obligation under the Sixth Amendment, we cannot simply forego any legal representation if we honestly believe that an individual has competency issues. I liken it to the Anders brief concept. I could no longer stand before this court in a capital case and say that there are no issues because my client doesn't want to pursue review unless I have made an adequate review of those issues and made that determination.
We're following up on Justice Resnick's question, which essentially is how does one in Mr. Berry's situation
effectively remove himself in the process?
That's right. The whole process begins to look really foolish if that can't be done.
Your Honor, you also have to consider what juncture we're in the process. Reason against Payton provides a unique standard. It's one where we are in the throes of reviewing an individual attempts to withdraw, or the court acknowledges that it's a legitimate issue. It's a different situation, say, when we go into federal court. If Mr. Berry is adamant that he is not to proceed in federal habeas corpus proceedings, then there's a significantly different burden that we have to meet to be able to initiate those proceedings on his behalf. And that is why there are the varying levels of proof, varying standards of competency to be determined.
What will it take to satisfy the Ohio public defender that Mr. Berry is competent? If this court determines a competency, we have two psychiatrists who have found Mr. Berry competent. You have put forth a psychologist that finds him not to be competent. If we make a determination finding Mr. Berry competent, will you then be in a position to cease his representation when he so desires you to cease it?
It depends, Your Honor, on how the court makes that determination. If you apply the correct standard of Reese against Payton, if you consider the clinical findings of fact of both those doctors and subject it to the single lowest standard of review that exists in criminal proceedings, then we would be certainly a more difficult position in pursuing federal rights. We also have to consider the actual next friend in that situation, which is the Wolfer Berry's family. So I can't actually project with certainty when it is that we would actually withdraw from a certain site.
So the answer is you plan to go on in federal court if you lose here.
Absolutely.
Sure.
There are fundamental rights.
There's really no end. And isn't that the thing that troubles almost everyone that looks at the death penalty scheme as it exists in Ohio?
There has been no end yet to any of our individual cases, John, because we haven't completed review yet. We haven't completed every case through this state direct appeal, through collateral review, and through habeas. In fact, the only two cases that got further enough in the habeas were ultimately reversed. The frustration I can understand, but the frustration should not obviate the real important issues here. We have to review these cases.
Mr. Bolin, on that same idea that we have to review, this, I want to talk about the procedural issue that you raised, which is that this court is without jurisdiction at this point in this case. And we're here on a motion by the state to really determine these underlying issues about further representation of Mr. Berry by the Ohio Public Defender. You take the position in your brief that this court is without jurisdiction, as our jurisdiction is defined in the Constitution, because this matter is not here on review.
Yes, Your Honor. Our position has been, certainly during the motions practice and continued, that once this court divested itself of jurisdiction under the direct appeal, this proceeding is now an extreme irregularity. It would have been far more appropriate for competency issues to be addressed at the trial court in post-conviction as they were raised. I understand the need for efficiency. It's certainly relevant, but with all respect, this isn't the way to efficiently deal with this issue. And by creating a very odd procedural irregularity, I also have to be concerned that we're opening up the door for other procedural irregularities, and that to the extent that efficiency and swift resolution of ultimate judgments is important, then that regularity becomes...
Now, you mentioned that the appropriate procedure would have been through post-conviction.
I think so, Your Honor.
Are you implying that at the same time then, even though Mr. Berry doesn't want to proceed with his state appeals, are you recommending that that would have been also an appropriate procedure?
I think it would have been an appropriate forum because the competency issue was specifically set forth in the post-conviction petition. As our direct appeal structure exists, because much of it obviously is off the record, we are somehow ill-equipped on direct appeal to deal with the specific issue of withdrawing from proceedings.
Well, that puts him, and I do want to get to the merits here, I think we need to get to the merits, but that does put him solely at the discretion of the judgment of the public defender, does it not? I mean, if we say, well, you have to wait for your post-conviction hearing to raise the issue of competency, he has no control over when that happens, does he?
I mean, again, it depends. There are so many different competency determinations that are made, Your Honor. This court certainly hasn't addressed the issue of whether an individual can withdraw from direct review when there is a constitutional and statutory directive that such review takes place. This type of competency determination is very fluid. It can arise at any time during the proceedings, direct, collateral, or federal habeas corpus.
Can't one waive their both statutory and constitutional rights?
You can, Your Honor, but again, under Reese against Tate, the standard is a test of caution. One can only forego them or waive them. If we are absolutely certain that they are not affected by severe mental disorder, then it's going to give it that decision.
But wasn't that what was determined in the Cuyahoga County Common Police Court recently, whether or not he was competent?
No, Your Honor. The trial court determined that Wilford Berry was competent by the Whitmore standard, which is a standard determined in Article 3 standing in federal court. It did not apply the recent against Page standard. And more importantly, if you look at Dr. Resnick and Dr. Alcorn's testimony, they determined that Wilford Berry was not actively psychotic. That was their standard. The highest clinical diagnosis possible is what they were looking for. It was the mere absence of active psychosis that led to their conclusions. If you consider their clinical findings of fact, under the Reason Against Payton standard, there is not a disagreement among the doctors. They all suggest that it's an enduring personality disorder. It manifests itself in rigid thought process. He can't take into account the important components of his case. And even Resnick and Dr. Alcorn both said that if he had a likelihood of success on the merits of the federal court, their diagnosis changes.
Well, having said that, would it be fair to say that if you follow the Reese standard, that in your judgment, even though one has a right to waive their constitutional rights, you would never be able to do it in this case because nobody would ever be competent to do that.
Not in Wilford Berry's case, Your Honor.
Can you ever think of a case where that could happen?
Oh, absolutely, Your Honor. Again, I can point you to Gary Gilmore's case. Under his diagnosis, the most severe debilitating disorder he had was an antisocial disorder. And that is not even severe. It doesn't affect the cognitive process. That would be insufficient under Reese against Payton. The difference here is,
you make the proposition under Reeves, and I'll quote from your brief, Reeves compels the finding of incompetence upon the mere possibility that an individual's mental impairment substantially affects his physician. When did the law reveal a mere possibility? That's a stretch of the Reeves case, as I read the Reeves case. How can you defend that sort of standard? How could anybody ever meet that sort of standard?
Your Honor, it can be, because what Reeves acknowledges, as do many of our competency cases, is that there are varying clinical diagnoses, just as there are varying legal determinations of competency.
So your argument is whatever doctor you found that would give a mere possibility that Berry was incompetent would be sufficient to meet the Reeves standard?
Yeah, whichever doctor, Your Honor, would find that he had a significant psychological disorder which might substantially impair his ability, not merely affect, but may substantially affect his decision in the premises.
Counsel, if I can distill this down, if there's a lot more to what you say is wrong with him, But what I get out of reading this and what you say is he's rigid in his thought process, and the evidence of that is that he doesn't think he's going to win on appeal, ever. Now, there are probably a lot of people, a lot of thoughtful people that may feel that's exactly what's going to happen. So is there more to his disorder than that? He sized up where he is in his case, what he's done, and the legal system, and he's convinced you're never going to win for him, so he wants to be rid of you. That's his disability.
No, that's disorder. That's the articulation of his reasons for withdrawing, Your Honor. The problem is that he has a schizotypal personality disorder, which all doctors agree is one of the most severe and debilitating of personality disorder. Under Reese against Page, the fact that it might impact that decision compels us to be cautious and further review of his case. That's all Reese against Page says. And I encourage you to apply that standard and find that Wilford Berry is incompetent for the further state of mind. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Bodine. Mr. Karras.
Would you address the jurisdiction first, Mr.
Karras?
Yes, Your Honor. Yeah, because I noticed
you
don't even answer it in your brief.
Did not anticipate, Your Honor, that they would raise the question that after this court had remanded this for the evidentiary hearing, that they would argue that the court did not have jurisdiction under Article 4. That's correct. Right. Under Article 4, Section 2B, 1F, this court has jurisdiction to render a complete determination. This case has not been completely determined. This court has the authority to issue a warrant of execution. The public defender has asked for a stay of that execution. The state is asking that stay be lifted and that this court enter an order of execution against Wilford Berry. If their theory were correct, Your Honor, the public defender would be in the posture then of making sure that they that sought a stay before the court issued its mandate, because under their theory that when the court issues its mandate, this court loses all jurisdiction, then the court would be the authority to issue a stay. It also seems to fly in the face of the Stepney case, in which this court did not have any case in front of it except a motion by the state to adopt a procedure for the handling of post-conviction cases. Your Honors, there are three factors that we believe should satisfy the court that it is being fair to all and that honoring Wilford Berry's request to be executed is in fact just. First of all, we have an individual in front of the court that says, I am guilty, I accept my punishment, I know what I'm doing, I know what I want to do. This is an individual who has a constitutional right to waive appeal, to waive the right to counsel. This court has held on numerous occasions that even in death penalty cases, that an individual has that right, and that is consistent with rulings from the United States.
Well, Mr. Karras, the public defender's office, as you know, argues that Reese is the test, and that we haven't asked the trial court to apply Reese or didn't direct the trial court to apply Reese, and the trial court did not apply Reese. What's your response?
Well, it's just not factually correct, Your Honor. I would refer the court to page 2 and page 3 of Judge Friedland's decision, which are at appendix 11 and 12 of our brief. The court says, in assessing the mental capacity component of competent determination directed by the Ohio Supreme Court, the court looked at the seminal case in this area, the Reese versus Payton, for the standard to apply. And then it announced the standard in Reese versus Payton, which was the standard as directed by this court. This court mentioned Reese in its order to the court. It's significant that Dr. Resnick and Dr. Alcorn used the standard that was from this court in reaching their conclusion. Dr. Pearson did not. She couldn't have, because she did her evaluation more than 2 years before this court issued the remand order. Now, the argument that they're making that somehow Whitmore adopts a different standard than Reese, we think is just wrong. Whitmore referred to Reese. The cases that they've cited in their brief, Heitnik and Rumbaugh, in both of those cases, the court put the burden on the person who was asserting the incompetency to show the incompetency. And in the Smith versus Armentrout case, which is the only case that we've been able to find where the burden was put on the state, and that was only by a preponderance of the evidence, the court specifically rejected the argument that Reese and Whitmore were different standards. So we just think it's not a legally correct argument to be made here. The court looked at the right standard. They looked at the standard that this court directed them to look at. And they made the finding. It's right here in the opinion.
Counsel, is the public defender's interpretation that Mr. Berry wants to drop his lawyer, drop his appeals, and go forward with the return out of the sentence premised on his rigid conclusion that he will not be successful in the further appeals? Is that a correct interpretation of where Mr. Berry's thought process is at the moment?
Well, Mr. Berry has told all of the examiners that he would prefer the death penalty as opposed to long time in prison and delays in the process only to find out that that would be the inevitable result. One of the problems...
So he doesn't prefer the death penalty over free.
No, in fact, he told all three of the examiners that if he had the option to being out on the street as opposed to the death penalty, then of course he would prefer that. But he just sees it as being a delay of the inevitable. But one of the significant things that Dr. Pearson did not include in the report was the fact that he made that very statement to her, and yet she concluded that there was rigidity of thinking with respect to the death penalty, when that in fact shows that he has the ability to weigh his options and make decisions, make choices. The
evidence, I believe, that the judge had before her was we have a gentleman with IQ around 100, which is average, no hallucinations, no suicidal ideology for the last 6 some years plus, logical thinking, had psychological problems, nobody denied that, but felt that he was able to make a clear decision. And the main evidence that I can see on the opposing side is back to this rigidity issue, this fixation that the other side seems to think he has on death. Yet he's already failed, or his counsel has failed, since he didn't wish it, at two appeals. So I'm challenged to see where the issues are. What I'm in common.
Well, one of the problems with Dr. Pearson's report, and I think we have to go back to the fact here that Judge Friedland conducted a full evidentiary hearing and made a credibility determination. One of the problems with Dr. Pearson's report and her conclusion was that you would have to disbelieve what Mr. Berry is telling everyone. He said, I'm not doing this because of ideas of suicide. I'm simply choosing to accept the punishment that's been imposed against me. And yet, Dr. Pearson says, well, that's further evidence of suicidal thought, even though there had not been any suicide attempt in the last 9 years. He reported to all three psychiatrists. He had no suicidal thoughts. He was not on suicide watch. He was not on any psychotropic medication. I mean, it starts with the conclusion that this was a childhood illness and that it carries through to the present day, and so therefore you have to disbelieve what he's saying to you now because he had these suicidal thoughts going back to his childhood. Dr. Bress two very eminent psychiatrists accepted what Mr. Berry was saying to him as being the wishes of Mr. Berry, that he was competent to make those decisions, that he was competent to articulate those thoughts, and the judge found that those were credible.
What's our standard of review for the findings by this trial court?
Well, I would submit, Your Honor, that the standard of review is clearly erroneous, the same as any finding fact. Now, I would say that they have argued in the brief for de novo, and we think that we can meet a de novo standard of review if you looked at the testimony of the two psychiatrists as opposed to Dr. Pearson's report. But the reason I think clearly erroneous is the correct standard is that you are judging what another judicial officer has determined here. Some of the federal court systems, when they refer a matter to a magistrate, they will use a de novo standard. But they do that for reasons not having to do with the integrity of the fact-finding process. It has to do with the fact that the magistrate is not an Article III judge, hasn't been elected, hasn't been appointed. You don't have that in this situation. You have a judicial officer. And we would submit that you shouldn't treat this any differently than if this were a case arising under the new statute. The issue was raised at the trial court. There's a direct appeal to this court. You would look at the findings of facts and conclusions of law, and you would judge whether those were appropriate as opposed to making...
Well, the judicial officer here was doing our work, wasn't she?
It was done as a result of the remand, but still a remand to a judicial officer.
I mean, this was not an appeal that came to us. It was an unusual action. I suppose we could have done what Judge Freelander did ourselves, couldn't we? We could have taken evidence and as an original action, but we, instead of doing that, we had her do it, had the trial court do it for us. I guess I'm wondering why we shouldn't review it as de novo.
Well, again, Your Honor, I think that we need any de novo standard.
I've heard you say that.
But I don't think that it necessarily follows that because this court has sent the matter back and retained jurisdiction to review the report that the judge has reached here, that it not be judged under the same standards that you would judge any findings of fact by the judicial.
Let me ask you, Mr. Karras, at what point do we in the judiciary relinquish our responsibility to be sure that everyone who comes through the justice system has had the full measure of justice? Is there some point? I mean, there was some reaction to the representation of Mr. Bodine that they were going to go to federal court next, and habeas corpus, of course, is the process in our country, whether one likes it or not. It's the process by which the federal judicial system make sure that the state proceedings complied with federal law. What's wrong with having that sort of examination for Mr. Berry in this instance?
Well, I think it's a fair question, Your Honor, and a tough question. The answer to it is that you can't do that without dispensing with another constitutional right, and that is the constitutional right of the individual to waive his appeal. This court has already determined that in the Tyler case that the individual doesn't have to present mitigation evidence. This court has the statute allows, if somebody wished to do so, to plead guilty to the death penalty. It seems to me that at some point in time that this court has to recognize that the individual has his constitutional right.
Can he waive what the Constitution and the statute mandate us to do?
Well, there is no constitutional right to post-conviction action.
I understand that, but we have to review these cases under 29-2905 as though it were any other criminal case. It's mandated by the statute.
It is mandated by the statute, and that has been done. I mean, Mr. Berry has been found guilty the sentence has been imposed against them.
So you're distinguishing the direct appeals from the post-conviction relief?
Right.
All right, now,
And I would even say, Your Honor, there, and I may be going too far, but that is as a matter of statutory right that the legislature
yes.
adopted for a check and balance. The U.S. Constitution has never held that there's even a constitutional right to the direct.
We're here on the competency issue, and that's the one thing I wanted to ask you about, because on page 14 and 15 of their brief, they indicate competency to stand trial is one of the tests, the affirmative defense is not guilty by reason of insanity, and the other two tests. I wrote the underlying Berry case when we affirmed his conviction and the death penalty, and I remember spending a great deal of time on the issue of competency because Dr. Goldberg at that time had examined him, and then the counsel never raised the issue of competency to stand trial until we got to the mitigation phase, or until they got to the mitigation phase. And then it started over, and the statute, as I recall it, specifically says, unless there's for really good cause shown, you don't change in the middle of the stream. What is your comment with regard to the history of the competency now that we're facing, after another two or three hearings, that he is competent?
Well, I think this court has been fairly fair to all concerned here by setting a fairly stringent standard with respect to competency and to remand this for a full evidentiary hearing. The issue now is that there are findings of facts, there are conclusions, there are credibility determinations. All of that evidence was before the court in making its decision.
In our remanding it could be said, I suppose, reviewing the underlying Berry case, that was all adjudicated early on, and we're taking a second or third trip back.
Well, one of the things that the judge did was she actually applied a higher standard of proof than what we think is the appropriate, but we think that we meet that standard, and she found that that standard was met. So even there, the court was solicitous of Mr. Berry's rights and of the directions from the court. Your Honor,
so we're really down just to their fourth test on page 15, the competence to decline further review.
That would be correct. I think that's
because all the other things have been determined along the way, and now we're at the ultimate question.
I think that's correct. But Your Honor, I would like to say 1 minute if I could for Mr. Satch.
You've used your time, Mr. Karras and Mr. Sad sitting over there hoping he's going to get to argue. You waving your right?
Should we let
complete.
Him? Should we let him wave it?
Thank you. Mr. Bodine, you saved 21 seconds, but take a minute.
We certainly cannot be and as you look to the rigidity factor, the important compelling factor that all three doctors focused on, that is best shown in light of the fact that Wilford Berry has to be executed when he was arrested. And he has continued to do that throughout this case. It has never changed. It's not based on his futility or his belief that his appeals are futile. It was from day one. That's the rigidity.
I went through sort of a list of how I summarized the state position. What is your best clinical medical evidence? That's really the issue we're here on. Other than that statement, which to me alone in and of itself doesn't carry medical clinical weight, what's your best medical clinical evidence that you need to come?
The best clinical evidence are the tests that Dr. Pearson administered. In fact, she's the only doctor that was not only qualified to test him in that manner, but the only one who did so. The MNPI is very responsive of his disorders, especially the validity.
But you concede you can have disorders and still be competent. Where is the connection?
It's the severity of the disorders, Your Honor. It is the MNPI, the Rorschach, and the other individual tests that Dr. Pearson administered to Wilford Berry.
And how does that manifest itself in his
action? It provides her the indications that dovetail into the DSM criteria to determine schizotypal.
But Reese requires that that disorder or defect substantially affect his capacity to make this decision.
How does
that tell me?
Again, you use the clinical testing to find a clinical diagnosis, which all three doctors are in some form of agreement on. And then the clinical diagnosis itself, according to all three doctors, then manifests itself in typical behavioral traits that are associated with a specific disorder. And this one, the most prevailing, is the fact that they are people that are unable to take in important information and unable to process it. There are certain other ones that are highlighted in a brief, and I certainly encourage you to look at that Millen text that we highlighted. It's a very good source of information about how the behavioral aspects of the disorder actually affect an individual.
That was going to be, I guess, at least related to my question. Will we find in the record evidence as to how the disorder that Mr. Berry has affects people generally? I mean, like an estimate of how many people in society have it and how they function?
Yes, Your Honor. There's actually very specific facts in there about the rarity of the schizotypal personality disorder. In fact, it's like 900. A person with a schizotypal personality disorder is 900 times more likely to either commit suicide or engage in a decision that's going to harm than any other person in the sample. We do note it specifically in the brief, in the statement of facts, and it is in the testimony of Dr. Jersey.
You basically are alleging that this disorder gives him a death wish. That's the essence of it?
It can, and in Wilford's case, I think it does. It renders him completely unable to really deal with and evaluate correctly important aspects of his case. And if you look to the fact that he's been asking for the death penalty since the day he was arrested, before it was even a reality.
Can you give him any credibility to the thought that he felt guilty and he felt that was appropriate because he had done the act?
No.
Is that a logical conclusion of a normal person could feel?
It might very well, Your Honor, but an individual cannot empower the state to do what the state cannot do, but the Constitution otherwise prohibits the state from doing. So assuming Mr. Wilford had a death wish and he was not convicted of aggravated murder, he couldn't empower the state. So you shouldn't grant that a whole lot of weight, but you should look at it in light of the rigidity component of the schizotypal personality disorder.
Thank you.
Thank you.
The case is submitted. You'll be advised of our opinion. The marshal, please adjourn court.
All right. Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. This open session. The Supreme Court of Ohio. Now stands adjourned.
Thank you.